Hey friends, hope you're doing well. I'm excited to share this episode with you today. I sit down with my online friend, Steve Knepper, who I've had on the podcast once before, and we discuss both his new article entitled Red Dragonflies, which explores how his own spiritual journey connects to some of the major themes in Byung Chul Han's writings. He even gets into one of the yet-to-be-translated books into English from Han entitled In Praise of the Earth, which is all about Byung Chul Han's garden from a philosophical perspective. It sounds fascinating. I can't wait for that to come out in English because I really want to get into it. And so in addition to this great article that you can read, there's a link in the show notes, we also look at Byung Chul Han's book Non-Things, which is one of my favorite Byung Chul Han books. I think Steve would agree as well. And we offer the main argument of the book and just explore various different aspects of what it means to relate to real objects, to hold them close to our heart, and to have a way to find a home here on this planet rather than just being lost in the digital. I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. There's a lot that we get into. Steve is just a really kind and generous person. I think he truly embodies what Byung Chul Han would call the central aspect of his overarching philosophy, which is friendliness or gentleness. And yeah, I just love connecting with Steve and look forward to many other conversations with him in the future. I know that in a few months, sometime in June, I think, in the UK, his new book with a few other colleagues introducing the philosophy of Byung Chul Han will come out through Polity Press, and that same book will come out, I think, in August in the United States, and so we'll definitely have to do an episode or two exploring that book when it comes out, so be on the lookout for that. I hope that you enjoy this conversation. I hope that it is something that challenges you and causes you to think about things differently and thus to grow as a person. Please share this with anyone who might be thinking about Byung Chul Han or wants to get into his work. And if you have a time, if you feel led to do this, it would mean so much if you'd take a few moments to just write me a positive rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. It means a lot and it helps people find this program. As always, I want to encourage you to take the time to really wrestle with some of the ideas in this episode. And as always, continue the conversation. Steve, it is so great to have you on Psyche Podcast yet again. I'm really excited about having this conversation with you. I know as we were thinking about what we'd talk about, we threw out a few things. It's very likely that we'll get into Byung Chul Han's book, Non-Things, which I think we both really enjoyed. But you've also written this incredible article entitled Red Dragonflies, which gets into several aspects of his work and then connects it to his and I think your kind of Catholic tradition, which I'm very curious and open to and would love to learn more about. But I guess before we jump into the actual conversation, would you maybe share any updates since the last time we talked, whether that's on a personal or professional level?
Yeah. First, thank you for having me on again. It was such a great experience talking about Saving Beauty with yes. you and Elizabeth a few months ago.
That was really fun.
And I'm really grateful to have the opportunity to come back and to continue the conversation.
Nice.
And to keep exploring Han's work and what it might have to say to us in our lives and society. So as for updates, I guess a big one on the home front is that my wife and I welcomed our third daughter, Cecilia Grace, back in November. So that's been really exciting. And a particularly exciting thing is I love her big sisters, but Cecilia sleeps a lot better than they ever did.
That's awesome.
So she's taking it easy on us as parents. So it's been a lot of fun, and they've been great big sisters though, and have helped out. And we've just had a lot of joy around that in our home. Professionally, I'm looking forward to the publication of this co-authored book, Byung Chul Han: A Critical Introduction, that's coming out with Polity Press in June for the UK, and then in August for the US. So working through proofs and just sort of putting the finishing touches on that is what's going on right now in terms of writing.
Yeah, that's great. Do you? I know this is maybe like a random question, but do you happen to know how long the book is going to be? I'm always curious about page numbers.
Yeah, it's not going to be a real long book. We want it to be kind of a concise, helpful introduction, exposition, examination of Hans' thoughts. So I think it's going to be right around 200 pages.
Oh, that's perfect.
We're still waiting to see exactly what it'll be with the index and things like that.
Okay.
But that's what we're looking at.
I feel like that fits just right, given the fact that he writes these really short, almost extended essays. So that's great that it won't be too long. And is the goal that it'll be pretty accessible for like the educated reader, or is it targeting more the academic side?
We hope kind of both. We definitely try to make it not only accessible, but kind of engaging and exciting in places. You know, we talk about a fair number of kind of pop culture, you know, movies, shows, where we see maybe some of Han's own concerns showing up out there in the culture. We crack a few jokes along the way.
Okay.
But then, you know, it's also a pretty serious exposition of his work. And we think that one of the things we think we do is we take a look at a lot of the untranslated early works of Han.
Okay.
And we talk about how that helps us understand, I think, in a bit more depth what he's up to in these works over the past decade that have been published in English. And I think some of the criticisms of Han that sometimes get rolled out against him, you know, are kind of addressed when you have that bigger frame and see how his project sort of has through lines across time. And hopefully some of those early works will eventually be translated in English. Philosophy of Zen Buddhism, which is a tremendous work. I know that you've really enjoyed that one.
Yes.
That's actually one of those earlier books, and it was only translated recently. So I think Polity in particular, I think, is committed to trying to bring out as much Han as they can. So some of those other earlier works might come out too. But also, you know, one of the things we do, we do register some of our own concerns or questions about Han's project.
Sure.
And we try to bring them into conversation with a wider range of thinkers. And we try to show some of the ways his thought might be extended. So yeah, we hope that it'll be a very helpful introduction and synthesis for those that are new to Han, but also has something to offer the scholarly community as well.
Oh, that's really well said. And yeah, I can't wait to read it. And hopefully we could have a conversation again to kind of unpack that. That'd be awesome.
Well, as soon as we get finalized proofs, I'll be sending you a set. Don't worry.
Oh, nice. Okay. Thank you so much. That'd be great. Okay. Well, no, that's super helpful. And so happy to hear about the new addition, Your Home. I think that's beautiful. I guess as we kind of jump into this conversation, maybe we could start with Red Dragonflies. I wonder, for the sake of the listeners, if you could just maybe talk about what led you to kind of put that article together. What were you thinking? What inspired it?
Yeah, so the editors of The Lamp magazine, which is a Catholic magazine, relatively new one, they put out a lot of really interesting and provocative stuff.
Okay.
They actually asked me to write a kind of review essay on Han. And they were generous. They gave me a fair amount of time to do it. And it started off as a very traditional review essay where I just kind of summarized some of his books and, you know, offered some synthesis, some extension, some criticism. But then as time went on, a couple things happened. One is I read Han's more recent untranslated book, his book of gardening meditations, L'Aube d'Erda, Praise the Earth.
And like I said,
that isn't translated yet. And it is such an amazing book. It's this journal about him tending a winter garden in Berlin. But each of the journal entries is a philosophical meditation, as you might expect.
Yeah.
And it's very personal. And, you know, Han's not a thinker that gives a lot of interviews. He's someone that I think, understandably, given his concerns about how we live in a transparent society where we don't sort of value stillness and privacy enough, you know, he doesn't often share a lot. But in that book, he shares a lot about his own experiences and his childhood. And I ended up, and his spiritual life, and I ended up weaving a fair amount of that into the review essay. But also, it kind of inspired me or kind of freed me to weave a little bit more of my story into it as well. And what drew me to Han and how Han has helped me try to live better in the midst of a distraction-filled and often pretty disturbing world. So the piece kind of morphed from a traditional review essay into, I think, more of a review essay that's also discussing kind of Han and spirituality and religion.
Yes.
And kind of a bit of a personal piece too, of the story of me and Han.
And I really like that dimension of it, the personal piece and how you kind of weave that together with his thought. Maybe that could be one of the places we start if you're open to that. Maybe, you know, I love the section where you describe sort of growing up on a farm, you know, and then a connection with your grandmother, and then after her passing and then the internet coming online, you know, kind of drifting from your spirituality and your faith and then kind of coming back to it. I think you were on a bus ride in college and you have this experience with nature. I'm wondering if maybe you could tell a bit of that story as a way to kind of set it up.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing I might mention is that this article, Red Dragonflies, is out from behind the paywall. So, you can just, you know, Google Red Dragonflies and my name, and it'll pop up if you're interested in reading it.
Oh, heck yeah. But I'll include a link in the show notes for sure.
Thank you. But yeah, I feel like a lot of my writing, a lot of my reading, has orbited the same set of concerns. And there are concerns with being in the moment, being present to others, sort of not getting too caught up in my head and preoccupations. Mm. I think a lot of my interest in art is around that, because I think art, one of the things it does is it draws us out of whatever kind of preoccupations, habituated ways of seeing, instrumental ways of seeing that we're in, and gets us to look at that artwork there or that poem.
Sure.
I mean, I think it's one of the things that it offers. And I think part of it is I've always been a little bit of a dreamy kid. I've always struggled a little bit with some obsessive compulsive. So it's been kind of easy in anxiety. So it's been kind of easy for me to fall into these ruts where I feel like I'm kind of in a haze.
Yeah.
Or where I'm sort of so wrapped up in my head that I'm not aware of what's going on around me or who's around me, right? So it's both something that drains vitality out of my own life, meaning out of my own life, but also can keep me from being being the person I want to be for those around me, the person I need to be for those around me. So, so I think that from, you know, the time I started like really seriously thinking and writing, these sets of concerns were part of it. But yeah, I grew up on a dairy farm, which is a great thing for pulling you into the real world for sure.
Oh yeah.
And, I really enjoyed that work. I loved working with the animals. It was a very small dairy farm. That was really a good thing. But dairy farming, especially at that time, was really a tough business, especially at the small scale that we were doing it. And it was before really there was like an organic movement or kind of a, you know, raw milk movement, some of these things that might have kept a farm of our scale alive. So you never knew what you were going to make for your milk from month to month. And it was really tough for my parents. So in junior high, we didn't sell the farm, but we did sell the cattle. And my dad, you know, went into work at a stone quarry and, you know, did some farming of the fields or rented out the fields. And sort of the part that I was most involved with, which was working with the animals, milking every day, that kind of went away. And around the same time, you know, the internet shows up. And I kind of, in hindsight, I kind of feel myself being sort of pulled out of the real world in the moment. And that's not to say that there aren't good things that came with the internet as well, for sure. But, you know, when Han says in Non-Things that we no longer live on the earth or under the sky, that we increasingly live in Google Earth and in the internet cloud, I think I felt that way back at sort of the dawn of the internet, you know, when you're waiting for the modem to dial in, for those that are old enough to remember that.
You've got mail.
you know, it's kind of like as waiting for that to click in, it was almost like I was leaving the world behind.
Yeah.
I think that was a real struggle for me throughout college into early grad school. And then, you know, I had this moment late in undergrad that I talk about in the piece where, I'm riding down the road, Interstate 81, in this charter bus, And I'm reading, of all things, I'm reading Thomas Pynchon's The Crying of Lot 49, which is this great postmodern novel, but sort of is shot through with, you know, paranoia and a sense of alienation. And so I sort of set this book aside and I just look out at the median, right? The filthy median in the middle of the highway. But there's this, you know, these first shoots of spring grass. Mm. And I just had this overwhelming urge to just go out and just stick my fingers into the grass and just to recover the moment and being more present in the world. And, you know, that's been a quest thereafter. You know, having kids too certainly pushes you to want to be in the moment more, right? For their sake, for your sake, to get the most out of these relationships. Han says in here that, you know, one of his concerns with smartphones is that instead of, you know, gazing at the face of the child, the face of the baby, and sort of giving them that human connection, you know, it's too easy for us to be looking at the phone, even as we hold.
So true. That was really convicting to hear that.
Yeah. And
that,
over the last
that
couple
we deprived
months,
them of the I'm gaze.
Just, yeah. You know, even over the last couple months, I think that I've done a pretty good job of that with my baby, but every once in a while I kind of catch myself and I'm like, this is exactly it.
Sure.
Because you become habituated into that, right? Any downtime, any time you're thinking there might be an email rolling in, anytime you hear that ding of a text message, it's just really easy to pull it out and check it. And it's very easy to sort of live in the sense of that digital layer, even when you're not really looking at the phone, because you sort of sense it, you're waiting for that ding. You know, they've done studies that say that if you have a cell phone sort of laying, you know, face up in front of you and a conversation partner, it like affects the quality of the conversation. And I believe that, right? And again, it's not that these things, I'm probably more balanced between goods and bads that I see in the internet than Han himself,
okay,
you know, seems to be. I value, you know, meeting people like you on the internet. And I feel like,
absolutely,
you know, it's grown into so real friendships.
Yeah.
But I do see all of the negatives that he points out as well.
Yes, yes. You know, okay, so in light of this, one of the things I loved about your piece was, and you were drawing from, I think primarily The Burnout Society, but a lot of his other books, talking about the shift from, you know, the disciplinary society to the achievement society, where, you know, the modal verb in the past we could say was the should, and now it's the can. You know, you can almost do anything. And so you mentioned, you know, personally, you'll be, you know, tempted to look at your phone, but it's not like your boss is requiring you to do that after hours or anyone else kind of in authority. It's wrapped up in our own sense that we can do this and that maybe we have something to accomplish or something to achieve. It's become a compulsion for us, I think.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and definitely there are situations when I think the smartphone, you know, Han says it's he acknowledges the way that it has allowed bosses and employers to demand your time anytime. But I think part of what he's getting at with that idea of the achievement subject is that even when that's not the case, it becomes easy to become habituated into pulling out that phone, compulsively checking, drawing you away from the moment. And, you know, even when you don't have to respond to that work email, you end up responding to it, things like that, right?
Right.
That's kind of, I think, what he sees as the really insidious dynamic, because it's easy to think that you're just sort of freely doing that and that's what you want to do. But often, even as you do it, you're there's kind of like a frustration or a barrenness about that feeling.
Right, right. It doesn't seem like a positive or life-giving type of freedom. It seems, at least to me, more like a type of slavery or just being tied down to something.
Yeah, and of course it's all being fed into algorithms that generate profits,
yes,
right? And it allows for you know, if you're answering emails even when you don't have to, it's the ultimate boon to efficiency, right? So Han is certainly aware of all of the ways that this is commodified and sort of reaches, it sort of suggests the way that the markets have sort of reached deeper into our lives.
Sure.
And how we've lost that sort of separation,
sure,
between an economic sphere and a personal life.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I think, you know, in some ways this is going to the end of your article, but I want this question to be another way to get into, I think, one of just the central threads throughout is, I think you highlight from several of his works that especially, I think the latest one in English, Vita Contemplativa, that he makes the case that, you know, even in the realm of religion, there's a type of crisis of attention. And I was wondering if maybe you could speak to that, you know, and then how that gets into how you've wanted to, in the article, bring up how Han could be a resource for the religious person or to help us think about something like rituals.
Yeah. So attention is one of these central concerns for Han. And he sees us as living in a time where it's really hard to have sustained attention. And part of that is that we struggle to sort of give our attention because we're so easily distracted. And part of that is because there are things like advertising that are really trying to claim our attention at any given time. You know, attention's become, in some ways, the hottest commodity.
Yeah.
You know, I think about things like, you know, I can remember the first time I pumped gas on a gas pump that talked to me. Ugh. I was like, this just feels so invasive, right?
Oh, yeah.
Or the first time I was at a urinal and there was an advertisement, a screen advertisement.
I remember the same thing.
It's just amazing how all these spaces that used to be spaces that weren't trying to claim your attention, right? And that allowed you a breathing space or a moment are suddenly now soliciting you, right?
If I can say something real quick, just because I've been thinking about this, just another way that I'm seeing this down here in Houston, where at least right now there's no laws against it, but I can't tell you how many people on the road are driving with their phones in front of them. And, yeah. it's almost a miracle that there's not more crashes or accidents. Talk about their attention being taken away from what they need to be focusing on. It's wild.
It is wild. And you know, if you just stand at an intersection, right, when you're trying to cross the street and you pay attention to how many people drive through intersections with their phones up.
Yes.
You know, probably, you know, one of the most dangerous moments, right? It's pretty wild. So Han thinks that in some ways our attention is being solicited all the time, but it's being broken up into little smaller and smaller units. So what we're losing is the kind of deep contemplative attention,
okay,
where we linger with things and we enter into sort of a deeper relationship with them. And that kind of attention is what stabilizes time, right? It gives time duration. So it gives something for us, but that kind of attention is also important for, you know, ethical responsibility. You know, Han doesn't, I don't think he quotes Iris Murdoch, who's a British philosopher and novelist who I like a lot, but she, along with someone like Simone Weil, who he does talk about, they make attention kind of the precondition for ethics, right?
Okay.
Because if you can't give someone your attention, you're going to not really attend to them.
Mm.
You know, and Han will say the same thing about listening, right? He says, you've got to weaken your ego so that you can make space to really hear the other and see the other.
Yes.
So yeah, this type of attention is important for ethics too. And I think that kind of sense of contemplative depth and, you know, ethical possibility, that's one of the things that religious ritual can bring. And, you know, religion is one of these places that's supposed to sort of develop our attention. Han in Non-Things, you know, quotes this idea that any kind of like serious contemplative attention is like a form of prayer.
Yeah.
And vice versa, you know, prayer is a way of developing contemplative attention. Ritual is a way of drawing us into the moment, giving us a sense of duration, giving us a sense of meaning, but also, you know, there's ways of focusing and building attention.
Yes.
And so, you know, Han suggests in a number of places that the crisis of religion, right? The one of the reasons why religions have lost or seem to have lost their hold in a lot of the West is that without attention, it's hard to sort of understand what religion's about. You know, it's not immediately gratifying, like, you know, maybe that video shooting out of the gas pump tries to be, right?
Right,
to draw
right.
you in. But it allows for sort of this deeper, richer experience. but you have to be kind of patient with it. And you have to build a capacity for it.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what's being lost. On the flip side, you know, Han doesn't deny any of the ways in which religion can be used to harmful ends, right? How it can, in certain cases, foment violence, or how it can, lead to hypocrisy or mistreatment of people. Anything that has to do with the ultimate can be used for means of power against others. Sure. He recognizes that. But he resists a kind of emancipatory narrative that's been pretty common, I think, in academic circles over the course of modernity, that thinks the loss of religion is just liberatory, right?
Okay.
Because he thinks that one of the things that's being lost with religion is the school for attention, right? So it's kind of this nasty feedback loop. We don't have the attention to really appreciate religion, but then we also are losing this place that's been one of the main places of building attention, the capacity of attention for society.
Absolutely.
So there's kind of that, one of the things I say in my piece is that I think that one thing that religious readers of Han can take away from it. I mean, I think things that could be taken into, you know, churches and synagogues and mosques and all kinds of religious communities is this idea that one of the things that we need to do is sort of teach people better how to attend and offer them, you know, these contemplative resources. And people are actually hungry for that, right? I mean, they're hungry for anything that will bring them more into the moment and will give them a sort of a depth of experience and allow them to enter into a richer relationship. So there's that sociological dimension, and that's kind of been sociological dimension in regards to religion. And that's been with Han all along, but there's also, I think, a true mystical dimension, right? This sense that that contemplation can put you in touch with the sacred or the divine, that you can enter into this relationship with the kind of nameless other, is what he calls it at one point in Non-Things. And in other places, he'll use more traditional religious language. Han himself grew up Catholic and still attends church, has not written a lot about that. And I think that he certainly wants to sort of talk to a broader audience than just pro-religionists.
Sure.
But, he talks about one interview about going around all these churches in Rome. And, you know, in one, he has this intense kind of religious experience of the Holy Spirit as the holy other, is what he says. Mm. So there he'll use traditional Christian language for it. So, yeah, so there's always been this kind of sociological concern with religion throughout his works. But there is also, I think, a mystical bent that's come more to the fore in recent writings.
Okay, yeah.
Sorry, that was a long answer.
No, man, because I know at one level you said in your article that there were a few things about his writings that, you know, kind of still left you wanting something more. And I kind of felt the same way. And so I found Red Dragonflies to kind of fill some of that out for me and connect some of what he's been writing with the more kind of religious or kind of mystical strand. So it's one of the reasons I really appreciated it. It was great.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I'm hopelessly a religious guy, right? I mean, I think that some of my most profound moments of my life have been intense moments of prayer and intense experiences that can have a transformative effect for all kinds of ways in your life. And I think that that's something that's become very awkward to talk about in many circles.
Sure.
So, you know, it was kind of gratifying to see Han move a little bit beyond just sort of a sociological treatment of religion to talking about that as sort of a depth of experience, which is, I think, been a big part of why people have, you know, gravitated to religion over all the millennia, right? It's not just about community cohesion, not just about building attention for other ends. It's about an experience of the sacred.
Mm. Oh, that's so good. Okay, so on that front, I was hoping you could help me understand a few things about what he says. This comes up in Non-Things, but then you also address it in your article where he makes that striking analogy between the smartphone and the rosary.
Yeah.
And I'm not exactly sure how to ask it, but I was just curious if you could speak to the rosary as, I'm assuming it's a ritual, and what Han is then trying to say by saying that our rosary today is like the smartphone, which I think is such a striking image for me.
Yeah. So that's such a great question. I think that there are a few different things I could say.
Okay.
I think one thing I would say is that it does become kind of, this kind of counterfeit ritual to pull out the phone and sort of scroll through it. I say counterfeit ritual because, I think he wants to distinguish between a kind of positive repetition that he sees with ritual and kind of like a more negative habit. And I think that there's something to that.
Yes.
But I think that there's something about the intensity of focus with which we do it.
Mm.
And that might be part of it. But there's also this sense that, he talks about the rosary and the smartphone as both being kind of disciplinary devices, right? In terms of, training our attention, training ourselves in a certain way, right? And I think he would say that the rosary, that can go in a good direction, though maybe at times it could go in a bad direction too. But here too, right, we see that this is a regime that's giving us a new kind of devotional device that's also a disciplinary device.
Gotcha.
And he thinks he wants us to take a hard look at whether this is really the kind of devotional / disciplinary device we want shaping our lives, shaping ourselves.
Mm. Yeah, that's so good.
He's very interesting on the question of whether he thinks that, say, like capitalism is a religion.
Okay.
In some ways, he would say that it does have elements of that, right? The belief in progress becomes like a hollowed out form of providence or something
sure.
like that. You know, the smartphone becomes a devotional object. But then he'll also sort of say that in a way it's not really a religion because it doesn't give you things like a way to It ends up sort of colonizing all of the sacred and draining the sacred out. I mean, I think is the most basic way to see it.
Yeah. And maybe this is just way too basic a way to put it, but I think Han and his philosophy would say that to be, I don't know if I think this is exactly right, but I'm just going to say to be fully human is to be connected to some type of sacredness. Maybe not everyone could agree with that statement, but I think he's pushing in that direction. Maybe I'm wrong about that. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that he would leave it broad and open-ended, right?
Sure.
Another way of making the point is that a key term for him that's easy to miss, but it comes up in almost all of his books. And in those early untranslated books, he really emphasizes it. And in an early work like Philosophy of Zen Buddhism, he really emphasized it. It's this idea of friendliness.
Oh,
right?
I was hoping we'd get into that. Yeah.
Yeah. And what he means by friendliness is something like opening yourself broadly to the world and to others, right? This kind of broad openness. And there's kind of a weakening of the ego that's involved in that. And a sort of generosity in opening out to the otherness, right? And in philosophy of Zen Buddhism, he says it's like becoming a guest house that's kind of opened out to the world. And I think another way of saying it is that everyone needs a relationship with the sacred. Another way of saying it would be an openness to otherness that's unconstrained by instrumentalism or by conceptual boundaries, a sense of just the other is mystery. And that goes from the divine and from God all the way to, I think, anything that you encounter, because nothing is ever sort of fully plumbed or grasped.
Yeah. It's interesting, just mentioning mystery as I was reading your work and remembering just a little bit of the Catholic theology that I've read, I couldn't help but think of Karl Rahner and ways that he would talk about God as like absolute mystery. Kind of keeping it, a little, I don't know if this is the right word, but keeping it kind of vague or open, but still something really central to his thought. And I thought, I wonder if Han could describe something like God as absolute mystery. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't want to overread into, you know, Han's religious beliefs beyond these like brief, you know, remarks he's made.
Sure.
But when he does talk about God, I think it is along those lines. You know, think about the Holy Spirit as the holy other.
Yeah.
Or the relationship in non-things that he talks about, the relationship to well, let me see if I have it. I maybe get that exact quote. Sorry, I should have had that ready to go.
Oh, no worries. As you looked that up, I thought it was super interesting that you connected his concept of kind of the other in the Holy Spirit to something even St. Augustine had written.
Yeah. So it might sound like a very postmodern formulation for Han, and in a way I think it kind of is, but it also echoes with things from the tradition. And, you know, he studied Catholic theology, and certainly in the time that he studied, Karl Rahner would have been a huge figure. So I'm sure that he's read lots of Rahner.
Okay.
So I found the quotation. He says, "Only in stillness and the great silence do we enter into a relationship with the nameless, which exceeds us, and in the face of which our efforts at appropriating the name seem feeble." Right. I think that's very much in the spirit of what you said. I mean, it's a very kind of apathetic or negative theology.
That's kind of what I was wondering about. Yeah. If he would kind of be a contemporary expression of a type of apathetic approach to theology, to things like that.
Yeah. I mean, that's my sense. And like I said, I mean, I think that he's, you know, I don't want to pretend to know more than I do, but based on the things that he sort of said, it sort of suggests in that direction.
Sure. Would you mind, you know, so just real quick, you know, since the article is entitled Red Dragonflies, would you mind speaking to why you titled it that and kind of where that comes from? I thought that was neat.
Yeah. So actually the editor titled it.
Oh, okay.
I thought it was really, it was a good title. I didn't mind at all. The editor there, Nick Rowan, is a really good editor. there's some editors that, you know, you feel like they might distort or mess your stuff up. And there's some people that you feel like, yeah, that's really in the spirit of it and helps it out. And he's definitely that sort of editor. It's a great skill. It's a gift to a writer. So Red Dragonflies, it's from in those gardening meditations when Han's recalling his childhood. He talks about playing next to this river in Seoul, Korea. That, you know, it was a pretty polluted river at the time, but there were all these dragonflies and he loved these dragonflies, especially the red ones. This idea of a profound ecological sensibility that's wrapped up with Han's sense of the sacred, I think that's important too.
Okay.
And that idea of friendliness is opening out to all others. You know, he's so indebted to Heidegger, but he also has his criticisms of Heidegger. And one of the most interesting ones, it seems like such a little thing, but he says, there's no insects in Heidegger except maybe one cricket or something that, he says, right? You know, this sense that Heidegger's openness isn't open enough. And certainly, you know, given that Heidegger has all kinds of ethical failures as a Nazi, I think just his sense of respect, ethical respect for the other just broadly is not enough, I think Han would say.
And I definitely don't know very much about Heidegger, but I thought it was interesting that you pointed out that Han, although he's a great admirer, I think he even did his dissertation on Heidegger's understanding of mood.
Yeah, that's right.
So right, he was a careful student of Heidegger, but he ends up pointing out maybe ways that Heidegger misunderstood Christian contemplation.
Yeah, he defends Christian contemplation against both Heidegger and Hannah Arendt.
Okay,
who are both thinkers that he admires in other regards and draws on constructively.
Yeah, he quotes them quite a bit in his books.
Quite a bit, right? He thinks that Heidegger kind of turns Christian contemplation into like analytical seeing or categorization, kind of like a scholasticism in the negative sense of the term, right?
Got you.
Which certainly isn't there in someone like Aquinas, you know, who would be, I guess, the main target for something like that. I mean, that's not what's going on with Aquinas at all. And, you know, Han says that the dominant note in the tradition is lingering with God and loving attentiveness as like Christian contemplation. And then with Hannah Arendt, she has this argument that the emphasis on contemplation in the Middle Ages kind of, and this is, you know, very much simplistic, and there's much more nuance to her account.
Sure.
But basically that ends up downplaying and hollowing out a notion of action. And Hans says that what you really need to have true action, he thinks that she's right to desire true decisive action that can act with intentionality, act with decisiveness, bring something new into existence. This is the kind of action you need for political life, meaningful political life. But he thinks you need contemplative space to give kind of a sense of purpose and direction to action, right? Contemplation is the space in which, among other things, you become collected, recollected, and intentional about action, right? So in the Christian tradition, there's always been this sense that action and contemplation go together, right? In the Gospels, Jesus will go off and pray repeatedly and then come back and engage in public ministry, right? Yeah. And that becomes the pattern. The Benedictine monasteries are all built around the sort of motto, work and pray. So that same back and forth between contemplation and action.
Sure.
And Hahn thinks that that's, you know, another one of these things that suffers in the contemporary society is if we lose contemplative space, he actually worries that we lose the capacity for decisive action, right? In sort of that richest sense. So I think Hahn can sometimes seem, if you look in certain places, as a little apolitical. I think that's one of the criticisms that gets leveled at him. But I think that one of the things he wants to say is that contemplation isn't a band-aid. It's like preparation for ethical action and political action.
Yeah.
And if we don't have contemplative space, we're going to be more likely to be stuck on like hamster wheels.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, a political debate of senses of political possibility.
Absolutely. I think maybe see if you agree or resonate. I think to that point too, I think I'm thinking of, is it the In the Swarm, the book In the Swarm? Mm-hmm. I think he's a big critic of what I think can be a common sentiment today that political action, you know, happens on social media. And maybe an argument can be made that can be a type of political space, but I think he's very critical of reducing it to that or thinking that you're making a massive change politically or doing real political work just by, you know, sharing an article or getting upset about the other side.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's spot on.
Okay. So, okay, let me go ahead, please.
I think he would say that, you know, it's very easy for political energies to sort of just be sort of turned into like emoting.
Okay. Yeah, that's well said. So Stephen, maybe in a moment we can transition a little bit into non-things, because I have some questions for you about that. But before we do that, maybe one final question about just Hahn in general and your article. You know, in several places, he will critique what I guess is my language, like a faux sense of friendship or community online. You know, if we have a lot of Facebook friends or, you know, even in The Disappearance of Rituals, he talks about we have a type of community that really isn't like an authentic community. My question to you, since you've read so much of his work, does he actually write much about what friendship or community could look like? Is that one of his interests in kind of unpacking that? Or do you think he's just kind of critiquing modern ways that we think relationships can and maybe should look like?
No, I think he does write a fair amount of what about relationships should look like. I mean, I think that the books that I think that that you can see that in a lot of his works, but especially in The Expulsion of the Other.
Okay, that's one I haven't read. I've read like 10 or 11 of his books, and that's one that's on my list.
That's one I suspect you'll really like when you read.
Okay.
I think that his concern about online relationships is it's very easy for them to turn into kind of self-gratification machines, right?
Oh, yeah.
Where you're pumping your online friendships for likes and shares.
Totally.
Or you know, you post about the struggles of your day so that you can get, you know, the kind of instantaneous feedback that you're looking for, right? And I think that he thinks that true friendship is a lot more substantial than that. First of all, you don't just see what you don't see your friend, and your friend doesn't see you, just in terms of what's been curated, which is very easy to do online, right?
Yes.
They encounter you more in your messiness. You can't just sort of get up and walk away. I mean, I guess you can, but I mean, that's not how it usually happens when you, you know, run into sort of a tense spot with a friend.
Right.
Whereas, you know, in an exchange online or in text, you can just stop messaging back and forth, right? So there is this element of friction and otherness that's at play there. But Han thinks that's a space of growth and necessary. I think he thinks that's a necessary aspect.
Gotcha.
You know, your friend might not just tell you what you want to hear. Your friend might tell you the necessary thing that you don't want to hear. You know, he points that out at some points too.
Okay.
But also, I mean, after just saying that, I think one of the things he talks about is that true listening, right?
Mm.
And true listening, you know, I shouldn't be saying this to you because, you know, you're a counselor, you do this for a living, right? You know this way better. You're better at it than I am. I can tell even across the screen that you're better at it than I am. But, you know, true listening is an embodied experience, right?
Yes.
You know, you can tell when someone is attending to you in present. And you can sort of tell that online, but it has a different feeling when it's right there.
Very much so.
So that embodied dimension, I think, is really important to him as well. I mean, those are just a few things. I think there are other things I could say, but that's
great, Steve. I think part of where that question for me comes from is I have this maybe unfair image of him as a bit, this is not bad, but a bit of a hermit or a recluse, or just it's almost like a monk, like a secular monk or something. And I just, maybe it's a bit of curiosity of, I wonder what his friendships look like. I wonder if he's, I know he goes to mass every day, but right, he goes when everyone else is leaving, I think he said. So I just wonder, you know, what are his thoughts about actual lived relationships and community? But you give me some great thoughts on that, though. This is really helpful.
Yeah, I have no idea in his own life what that looks like. You know, you get the sense when you watch the documentary, which is on YouTube. It's an older documentary now, but it's the one
Elizabeth shared that with me. I still haven't seen it. I need to watch that.
It, you know, starts in Berlin and goes to Seoul. It's really good. It's worth watching.
Okay.
I really like it, and I feel like there's a lot of real insights into that and into his philosophy that he offers there that you maybe don't see in other places. But you know, he definitely, when he goes back to Seoul, he has friends that he, you know, reconnects with, and,
okay.
You know, it's, you know, I don't want to sort of speculate about autobiography with him, but I think one thing that you can say about, any thoughtful person that has sort of lived through the transformations into the digital age, probably will remark on kind of the loss in in-person communication, right?
Oh, yeah.
I think they might weigh differently what's been gained. Some might see that as sort of worth it or a good thing. Some might be more critical. But I think that sense that people spend less time in meaningful interactions together. And I think that's particularly pronounced over the last decade, even starting before COVID. I mean, the numbers seem to bear that out.
Absolutely.
And I think Han is not just against digital technology. He's also for that kind of deep embodied relationship. One of the other things he says about friendship that I think might be significant or worth thinking about is that, and he says this about romantic relationships too. And he talks a little bit in Agony of Eros about Badiou's little book, In Praise of Love, which is a great little book.
Yeah. And I mean, didn't Badiou write the foreword?
Forward.
Yeah.
But one of the things that Badiou says, and then sort of Han picks up on, is that in a close relationship, whether that's a relationship with a lover or a friend, or like a true friend, you no longer see the world just through your eyes.
Okay.
You also have a sense of being with someone close that's seeing the same thing in some ways similarly, in some ways differently.
Mm.
So you get this sort of sense of a doubleness of perspective, right? And that's, I think, a really important thing, because it's very easy to sort of take your way for seeing the world for granted. And one of the things that close friendships, close relationships can be is reminders that other people see things differently, right?
Yes.
And you get those joys of where your perspectives enrich each other's. And then you get those harder moments where you realize how differently maybe you see something from someone that you care about. And again, I think that Han would say that that's the positive kind of negativity, right? One of the things I think he wants to say is that in our society, we've lost the difference between coercion, between being sort of insulted, which are awful forms of negativity that, you know, you shouldn't have to deal with.
Sure.
But then the sense of it's easy to go from that to the sense that any kind of discomfort is bad. And Han would say, for sure, you can't learn, you can't grow, you can't have a meaningful life without some discomfort, without some struggle, without some resistance or otherness that you're encountering.
That is so speaking my language and resonating with me. I think what you just said is yet another reason why I find him as such an interesting and thought-provoking thinker.
Yeah, and I think that he's really interested in trying to understand where we are right now.
Mm.
And I think that he thinks that a lot of thinkers are sort of stuck 20 years ago, and they haven't sort of seen how, you know, the sort of the downsides of some of the digital transformations, even things like the move in schools to all affirmation all the time.
Right.
You can be whatever you can be. Right.
Yeah.
That just sounds like such a nice slogan. But then, you know, as life goes on, you can see you can't be everything. Right. And it can sort of turn into this thing that flips around from being inspiration to being something that actually kind of tortures you, right?
Yes.
Whereas if you have something like you can grow, right? You can learn, right? Those things are much more, I think, humble goals.
Yeah.
But good ones, right? And learning and growth involve both affirmation and challenge.
Absolutely. Very hopeful. It's interesting. I felt like I didn't use his name or even any of his books, but I was kind of channeling Han the other day. I was working with a young woman who is trying to figure out the next step in her life. She's kind of in a bit of a kind of gap year between high school and college. She's just trying to figure some things out. And, you know, you could tell there was just a lot of angst around identity. Who am I? Who am I going to be? And we explored that, but I also asked her to really wrestle with, have you thought about the fact that at some level, not that you want to limit yourself, you kind of have to think about who you're not as well, that a type of negativity is important to kind of linger with and to wrestle with.
Yeah, I think that's right. Because we can sort of be sort of stranded in a sense of just possibility, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the other thing, you know, Han in another one of his books, The Palliative Society.
That's another one I haven't read that I have in my bookshelf. I'm assuming that's probably one that I'd like as well.
Yeah, I really like that one too. But he has a really cool chapter on Hegel where one of the things he says is that in order to really learn, you've got to offer an idea and then you've got to encounter the counter arguments to it.
Okay.
And then in that, it's where the idea gets tested and grows, right?
Mm.
And that's how thought works, right? Thought is sort of that dialectical back and forth where your ideas have to meet resistance in order to actually grow and to strengthen and to become mature. And so, you know, I think he worries at times that education loses track of that necessarily, agonistic element, right? That, again, shouldn't be It's not like you need teachers, you know, driving students towards difficulties and humiliating them when they don't achieve, but that sense that it's okay, actually, it's important to encounter difficulty in thought.
Yes. Oh, man, I love that so much. Okay, Stephen, would it be okay to transition for just a little bit into his book, Non-Things? And I have a kind of a question that I really want to start with, which is in our kind of email correspondence, I think you might have mentioned that this is, if not your favorite Han book, one of them, and definitely the one that you recommend or encourage people who are new to his work to kind of start with. And I'm just curious if you could kind of answer both sides of that kind of statement, like, why is it your favorite or one of your favorites? And then why is it one that you kind of encourage people to start with?
Yeah. So in part, it sort of depends on the person.
Okay.
You know,
I like that.
Sort of tailor your recommendations to what the person is interested in and things like that. But I think it's a good, so a lot of people start with The Burnout Society, which is a great book. It's a classic for a reason, I think. But one of the dangers of it is it's very manifesto-like. So it offers a very stark division between the disciplinary society and the achievement society, and acts like we've entirely left the disciplinary society behind, which obviously isn't true.
Right, right.
You know, there's much more sort of hybridization and not a full paradigm shift. And Han himself certainly recognized this in his later books. So in some ways, that juxtaposition is never sharper than it is in The Burnout Society. And I think that a lot of his criticisms of him come from that, actually.
Okay.
And the other thing is it starts with talking about how we're no longer in an immunological age, which after COVID, most people, you know, if they can make it even past those first four pages, is an accomplishment to some extent, right?
Sure,
so
sure.
There's a way in which it's still a tremendously important book. But I think there are some liabilities in starting there, in that I think you don't see Han in his most nuanced, and you don't see Han in his most recent. Another thing that hasn't happened yet in The Burnout Society is he hasn't taken this. My co-author, Ethan Stoneman, talks about how he takes kind of a media studies turn shortly after The Burnout Society. He really gets interested in technology. You know, you start seeing him quote people like Marshall McLuhan. And he gets, you know, much more fine-grained in his analysis of digital technology.
Got it.
So you don't really see that in The Burnout Society very much yet either. So Non-Things, you kind of get all of that, right? And I think you get a lot of his main concerns with, like, contemplation.
Yes.
And you get that kind of wonderful, kind of autobiographical, lyrical final chapter about the jukebox.
Oh,
which
I love
is so
that.
Unlike anything else in Han's writing.
That was
even,
so cool.
Even the gardening journals are nothing like that. I mean, it's just, it's in its own register. And I love that piece. And I think it's a very winsome piece.
I agree.
So that's another reason I think it makes a neat entry point. You know, Non-Things, I think, basically the gist of the argument for those that haven't read it.
Yeah, that would be helpful.
Is something like more and more of our life is spent with smart technology, right? So smartphones are a big part of it. But then, you know, you have, you know, like Alexa, you have increasingly all your appliances are smart appliances. Your watch is a smart watch. And instead of, and what these things are doing now are always presenting you with information and with data and sort of, you know, you're always in this cascade of data. And what he thinks is happening is actually like tangible things, tables, chairs, you know, stuff like that. The things of the world.
Right. Things we can hold in our hands.
Things we can hold in our hands. Books, physical books versus ebooks.
Yeah. Vinyl versus, you know, Spotify songs.
That's right. You're losing more and more of that, and you're sort of living more and more in a digital world, or you're grappling with data rather than things. So he calls these kind of smart objects non-things.
And
I think the most like concrete illustration would be something we've already touched on is if you're always looking in your smartphone, you're just oblivious to the world around you, right?
Sure.
So he thinks in a way it's making that world around the smartphone disappear. And I think he thinks there's several things that are bad about that. On one level, he says those things are often spying on us, right? They're trying to design a better algorithm to sell us things and to monitor things about us. And I think he thinks we should have some privacy and security concerns about that.
Yeah.
You know, I would agree. On another level, I think he would say that it's existentially kind of exhausting, right? Mm. Because it used to be, you know, you could just sit down at your table and have your breakfast and kind of have that contemplative space. But now you're looking through the smartphone, right?
Yes.
And I think another thing is, I think he sees it as the newest intensification of kind of consumerism, because all of these smart things, you know, the phones, a smartwatch goes out of date so much more quickly than like a family heirloom watch, right? Or even like a cheap watch that you buy at a junk store.
Right.
In the documentary about Han, he loves to go to this Berlin junk store, he calls it, and rescue things, he says, right?
Oh, that's awesome.
So, you know, you can have this watch that you wear for years. If it's like an analog watch, right? The right kind of analog watch. So there's this disposability, right? And so I think those are some of the concerns that he has. I think another concern, one last that I'll mention,
sure,
is that I think he worries about humans becoming kind of de-skilled by all of this, right?
Yeah.
So a thinker I really like a lot is Matthew Crawford, who wrote a great book about attention, The World Beyond Your Head.
Okay. See, he has a great one on driving too.
Yeah, that's right. And Han actually cites The World Beyond Your Head in Non-Things when he talks about the Mickey Mouse Club.
Yes.
He talks about how old Mickey Mouse cartoons, the world's always like putting up friction and resistance, you know? People are crashing and people are struggling to navigate the world. But then in a new Mickey Mouse Club, whenever they encounter a problem, like they say, like, oh, toodles or something like that. I think that's the exact phrase.
Yeah.
And then suddenly like this robotic machine comes out and gives you things to fix your problems and sort of smooths it all away. You know, obviously this is just one show, but both Crawford and Han sort of suggest that this is actually revealing about more and more what life is like, right? That we're losing sort of skilled interactions, whether that's, you know, fixing your own car or fixing your, you know, house or thinking hard about things.
Yes.
Instead of memorizing things, you know, all these parts of all these things that are empowering in their own way, sort of are being lost. And driving's a big one too. You know, Crawford has a book about that. And
yeah.
Han makes a similar remark about self-driving cars, right? You know, maybe they'll be safer, but you know, that's one of the few places Crawford says that most people still have like a skillful interaction with the world.
Right. Right.
And it's something lost with that.
Yeah. I think, you know, just to add another layer, I think this was Crawford who kind of brought this to my attention. At least this is his speculation, that one of the potential dangers, and I think Han would agree with this, of like self-driving cars, it would probably be another way for those ads to just pop up, right? And to kind of grab our attention.
Exactly.
Forget the urinal and the gas station. Let's go ahead and add it to our cars too.
You can just put it right across the windshield.
Exactly.
You don't need to be looking out at the world anymore.
No.
Yeah. I think that's right. So yeah, that's some of his concerns. And so part of the book is his critique of this rise of data-infused non-things.
Okay.
And then the last part of the book is about kind of recovering a richer relationship with things and that contemplative attention. He talks a lot about, you know, he brings up Hannah Arendt in a positive way. She's in some ways, I think, the main figure of a lot of the book.
Okay.
Because she talks about how, you know, we're always sort of changing all the time. We're changing our mind, we're changing our situation. Humans are very changeable things. But having like the same surroundings actually stabilizes us, right?
Mm.
Coming to sit at the same table, walking the same street. So there's this stabilizing effect that concrete material things bring to our life. But if we're not paying attention to those, if we're always sort of sucked up into a digital world, or if we're just consumerists, always discarding, right? Then we don't build up that kind of stable relationship with things.
Sure.
And we also lose what Han calls things held close to the heart, right? So he talks about
yes.
a treasured photograph that's actually like a real world photograph that, you know, you kind of meditate on and you kind of build up this relationship with over time. It becomes sort of like a secular icon in some ways.
Yeah, I like that.
And then, you know, I love having phone pictures on my phone too, but there's something much more ephemeral and you don't have the same kind of lasting relationship with those.
Agreed. Yeah, no, that's really awesome. Okay, so I definitely wanted to bring something up from the book just to kind of get your thoughts on it. And this is another example for me of how Han tends to kind of flip things on their head a little bit to get me to like really, really think about it. So, you know, and I'll just say this, it's in the beginning of the chapter from possessing to experiencing. Over the last few months, I've really kind of gotten deep into the work of the psychoanalyst Eric Fromm. And you know, yeah. And Fromm has this book, To Have or To Be, where, you know, maybe it's a bit simplistic, but it's describing two orientations, one of, you know, possessing and accumulation. The other one is, I think, more in line with a type of, you know, contemplative being and just kind of almost like a Zen idea of just kind of just existing in the world. But I love what Han actually does is he says in his kind of framework that we now want to experience or be but not have, and I just wondered if that kind of language resonated with you and kind of how you make sense of kind of that distinction in light of what Fromm was trying to do with it, because he was saying, you know, Fromm doesn't quite understand the way things have changed in like the digital world, and I think he's right, but I was just curious if you kind of had any further thoughts on that.
Yeah, Fromm's one of those thinkers that I need to know better. And that passage in Non-Things stood out to me as well, because a thinker that I like quite a bit, Gabriel Marcel, a French existentialist,
sure.
He sort of makes a similar, he has a book called Being and Having. And, you know, being is always, I've kind of seen as the privileged pole for exactly those reasons. It's not, you know, grasping, it's not acquisitive. It's the space where you can have a deeper relationship. And I think Han would agree with that. But I think what Han's trying to get at is the way that that can be counterfeited or co-opted, right?
Yes.
In sort of like commodified experiences. And how often those experiences don't enter into that deeper contemplative lingering relationship.
Yes.
So, you know, you can imagine, for instance, this is actually an example that Marcel gave way back in the early 20th century. He said that Marcel himself loved to travel. But he said that one of the dangers of being a traveler is that you go to a place and you treat it as something to consume. You have your guidebook and you're just like, I saw this, I saw this, I saw that. You go in and out and you've basically superficially consumed this experience, but you haven't entered into any kind of real depth of relationship with the place or its people.
That's so good.
And I think that now, you know, that's intensified by, you know, you go there, you know, it's not only that you're ticking it off in the guidebook, it's that you're taking your selfies and your pictures, right?
Yeah.
Instead of just being. So I think that's kind of what he's getting at. I think he's getting at this idea that it might seem like the move from things to experiences is progress. But if these experiences are themselves highly commodified and are pursued in a consumptive way, then really it's just kind of a new form, new intensification of having, in a way. Only here it's like you're having experiences.
Yes.
You know, one thing I thought
I agree with that's great.
Sometimes it can be very well-meaning, right? But like if you go to an art museum, I feel like sometimes things can be over-curated, right? Like,
sure.
You know, they want to tell you all about the life of the artist and the historical context. And that's that stuff all has its place. But, you know, in a way, it can also prevent you from just lingering with the artwork and giving it, you know, deep attention.
Sure.
So, I mean, I think that that's, you know, partly to his point about, you know, the injection of more information isn't always leading to a richer experience. In fact, it can sometimes get in the way of that.
Right.
But also, you know, it's almost like you need all these things to consume rather than just being with the artwork.
No, that's really good. You know, okay, so another thing that I just kind of wanted to throw out there is I don't think Han would be opposed to any kind of critique of like what I think is a problem in the United States, like hoarding or having like too much stuff, you know, like obviously.
Yeah.
But I was just sort of energized by a book that was almost bringing back the importance of tangible things, like I said, that we can hold in our hands and close to our heart. I think he is right that while, yes, we see probably a lot of junk out there that people just kind of hoard, and that could be a type of issue, I don't know that we have a healthy relationship to things like he describes. And that was just really challenging for me to kind of think about ways that I could reintroduce that into my life.
Yeah, I think I had a very similar experience. And I think that for good reason, we've been wary of things for a long time because we think about just buying more things. It just becomes like a form of consumerism, right?
Right.
What Han kind of reminds us of is that, you know, we're creatures that have to live with things, right? We yeah. need cups to drink out of, right? Yeah. We need a roof over our head, right? These are constants of the human condition. Mm. And they had an existence and a significance, a deep significance, before they became commodified, mm. right? So in a way, and this is more my interpretation than what he actually says.
Sure.
But what I see him doing is not sort of championing, like I don't think he has a nostalgia for like the 90s style consumerism that you and I think probably grew up with.
Yeah.
As much as he's sort of seeing this next turn to information and experiences mm. as like an intensification of that.
Okay.
And
yes.
actually, perhaps with the 90s consumerism, there is still this lingering connection to the deep history of things, right? And you can take, you know, again, with his junk stories, like you can recover the commodified consumerist item in like a richer way, right?
Yeah.
You know, this is another sort of difference between him and Heidegger. He kind of agrees with Heidegger, and so does Arendt, that, you know, mass-produced things are clearly more disposable. You know, they're more likely to be infused with advertising. They're more likely to be designed to be disposed. Mm. Whereas, you know, crafted things, handcrafted things, have a different kind of warmth, is what Han mm. says. I think that's right.
I think
but,
so too.
You know, he loves the jukebox, right?
He loves the
so
jukebox.
So it's not like all mass produced things for him are automatically bad, and that we need to go back into the Black Forest hut with Heidegger, right?
Right.
I mean, and one of my refrains throughout the critical injection that I write is that I think one of the things that Han wants to do is bring this Heideggerian notion of dwelling mm. out of the Black Forest into contemporary life, and think about how we can do it in different settings than like his agrarian kind of
sure.
almost imagined, even at that time, peasant existence. And in a, you know, in a sense, in a world that's, you know, more cosmopolitan in a good sense. Right. So, I mean, mm. I think he wants to recover what's insightful from Heidegger without sort of, you know, trying to turn back the clock in a way.
Yeah.
And I think that his relationship, or how he talks about, you know, mass-produced items, is sort of like that. I mean, he thinks that you can recover those too from just being throwaway consumerist items mm. With the type of relationship that you build with them.
Sure, sure. And you know, to that point, I was thinking, I don't know if I forget where it was published, but in one of his recent interviews, he said that he had a phone, but he really only used it to classify the plants in his garden, right? You know?
Yeah.
So I just thought that was interesting that even he would have a type of smartphone. I figured he probably wouldn't, but he's just very conscious about how he's utilizing it. And I think that's important.
Yeah. And he studied metallurgy. And as a kid, he loved yeah. to sort of tinker with things. And yes. he says he still is a technophile in some ways. And I think that you see that with the jukebox. And again, right?
Yeah.
It's like, this is a technology that has a presence. You know, you can hear the whirs of the jukebox working, he says, and you can sort of work on the jukebox, right? So it's kind of, I think he has a real love for like analog technology in a lot of ways.
Yes.
And he's not simply anti-technology at all.
Okay. Yeah. No, I agree. Okay, well, so Steve, I feel like I've come to the end of the questions that I had for you. I'm wondering whether it's your essay or non-things. Is there anything else that you wanted to kind of throw out there before we come to a close?
Maybe one more thing
sure.
that I really love about non-things is he talks about this little tiny Kafka story. It's like a page and a half. You can find it online about this weird kind of bit of animated flotsam that lives in a house. It's called Odradek.
Okay.
Did you pick that up?
This house is
kind of haunted by this weird thing, right? And it kind of looks like a spool with like wooden legs. So it's thing-like, but there's something elusive and weird and uncanny about it. It kind of haunts this house.
Right.
And I think that's the other thing that I really kind of liked about his book. It's like, you know, when you sort of pay more attention to the terrestrial world, terrestrial surroundings, you know, you just recover this kind of delightfully weird, uncanny sense that, well, yeah, things actually in a way are expressive, right?
Yes.
And the world is charged with presences and other lives, right? I thought about, you know, when I was at one point, my wife and I lived in a really old house that was very creaky, and you know, all the windows, the wind would come through, and there were always like bugs, and sometimes even like snakes got into the house twice because it was at the edge of the woods. And in a way, I miss that because, you know, you live in like a climate controlled house and you kind of feel sealed off to the world, right? But like, I like that with the Odradek story, it's sort of calling you back to this, kind of funky weirdness of just living
sure.
in the world if you're paying attention to it.
You know, I'm so glad you're bringing that up because, and I don't know how to say this without getting into metaphorical language, but I did get the sense that he was, again, in a playful way, describing how real things, not the non-things that he critiques, are almost alive, or you know, he's talking about a vision of the world where things are almost re-enchanted again. And I don't know if that's literal, but metaphorically, it really hit me and resonates with me, this idea of like a vibrant matter.
Yeah. And I'm glad you brought it up. That's a Jane Bennett book that he quotes.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I haven't read that. I don't know if you know much about that, but that was really interesting.
Yeah. It's a really interesting book. Yeah. And this idea that things do sort of shape us and have more agency. Then we tend to think of them as just inert, right? And
right,
not
right.
think about how they shape an environment or things like that. I think it's both literal and metaphorical in some ways with Han.
Okay.
I would say.
I like that. Okay. Well, Stephen, again, thank you so much for your time and your wisdom and insight into Han. And thank you for writing that essay. I can't wait to share that with more people. Yeah, and I am really looking forward to the book coming out, The Critical Introduction, and yeah, maybe we can kind of hop back on a conversation and discuss that with even your colleagues, if they'd be open to that. That'd be amazing. They'd want to have a conversation.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you. And yeah, I hope that you will continue the conversation.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.